I'd like to share a brief reading as an excerpt from the Los Angeles Times, March 11th, 2012. It was a reflection from Mike Nichols, the well-known American film and theater director, producer, actor, and comedian, as he was embarking upon directing a revival of Death of a Salesman on Broadway, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman. Mike says, "It is Willie Loman's singular tragedy that he can't understand that true success," says Nichols, "is simply the ability to change. Willie can't understand the joy of changing yourself even by a millimeter. Even if you get 5 millimeters of difference in your life, not bad," he says. His eyes behind stern, dark-rimmed glasses suddenly moisten. "I don't like to talk about my kids, but their ability to learn and adjust and change moves me more than I can say. It's the one characteristic you want for them. Learn, do something else, change." In Death of a Salesman, the diamond shining in the dark, hard and rough, turns out to be death itself. While Nichols once said, "Get the world to revolve around you and you think you're never going to die," he says that he has no such illusions. "Oh my God, if I know anything, I know I'm gonna die. I never forget that. I know I'll be forgotten in a minute, and that's just fine with me." He tells the story of watching the film Elizabeth one night when he couldn't sleep. He was stunned by how good the Cate Blanchett movie was and how gutsy its heroine, Queen Elizabeth I. The next morning over breakfast, he told Sawyer about the movie, how Elizabeth stood up to the Pope, killed all her enemies at the same time, just like in The Godfather, and was not only right, but right forever. And recalls Nichols, "Diane said one of the greatest things she ever said to me, if forever matters." As Death of a Salesman points out, it is the love or damage that a spouse and parent leaves behind in the here and now that ultimately matters. Everything else is a delusion, says Nichols, "and that's what I'd like on my tombstone, if forever matters." In this time of the pandemic, so many of us are deluged, it seems, with dozens of unanswerable questions, each one competing for our all too limited attention and capacity to focus. How long is this going to last? How do we keep ourselves safe? How are we going to make it financially? How do I live with this kind of uncertainty? As we vacillate between one question or another, whichever happens to be working us over at any particular moment, there might in fact be one question that lies beneath all the others. What matters? As you know, I serve as the chaplain at the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. And last fall, as a part of the UCLA Centennial, I was invited on behalf of the UCLA Department of Arts and Architecture to be a presenter at their special 10 Questions event, the Centennial Edition. It was a series of 10 evenings, each one devoted to one particular question for our times in the world in which we live. Each one was to be explored by an interdisciplinary panel of three. When I told my husband, Scott, about how excited and honored I was to have been invited, he of course asked me, "What's your question?" "What matters?" I said. "Oh," he said, "everything and nothing," and then he left the room. Pithy, yes, but also true in a way. Everything matters and nothing matters. Our individual lives, such as they are in this very moment, are in fact a culmination of countless choices and decisions we have made, both large and small, over the course of our lives. Each one was shaped and informed by our sense of what matters at the time. Do I marry this person or not? Do I pursue this career or not? Do I live in this city or not? Or on a whole other level, do I buy this new pair of shoes or save my money? Do I eat that last piece of chocolate cake or let it pass me by? Each decision was a reflection of our sense of what mattered. On a national level, we only have to look as recently as less than a year ago at our national Democratic presidential primary debates to get a cross-section of what matters. Day one of my presidency will be addressing healthcare reform. No, day one for me will be cleaning up the corruption in Washington or dealing with climate change or the catastrophe happening at our southern border. And in the span of really very few months, just look at what has happened. All of that has been trumped, you should pardon the expression, by the pandemic. Does that mean all of those things don't matter anymore? Of course not. It just means that this matters more right now. This has captured our attention. And yet on a whole other scale, do you know what else matters? That you get home safely from your next outing to the supermarket, or that we have enough cat food, that Rupert has been fed, or that I have milk for my oatmeal tomorrow morning. I think ultimately what matters is the thing right in front of us, this very moment. I remember in the early 80s reading a magazine interview with Rosalind Carter. This would have been not long after she and Jimmy had moved back to their home in Plains, Georgia, after leaving the White House. At the time of the interview, I remember she was busily engaged in laying a new brick pathway up to the front stoop of their house. She commented to the interviewer how astonishing it was to reflect that very few months ago, Jimmy and I were living in the White House, hosting state dinners, Camp David Peace Accord, all of that. And now the most important thing in the world is that this brick is straight. And it matters, she said. Though I was such a young man, I was so struck by the profundity of that, so much so that it still sticks with me 40 years later. It's kind of Zen-like, isn't it? Around the same time, I remember taking some kind of self-development seminar or another, after all, it was the 80s, in which we were given the task of writing our own epitaph. Now, if you've never tried it, it can be a daunting exercise, but also quite illuminating. It becomes even more daunting when we have to do it for real. My mom died a year ago, April. You know, there's only so much room on those little bronze plaques. Which few words are you going to choose to summarize, to encapsulate an entire human life? What I chose for myself in my early 20s was, he was moved by life. I think what matters is really quite fluid and changeable over the course of a lifetime, maybe even over the course of an afternoon. What mattered to me at 25 is not what mattered to me at 45. Which bears little resemblance to what matters to me today at 65. I think in the first half of life, we're so focused on achieving our goals, accomplishing something, perhaps starting a family, achieving success, as if we have the vaguest idea what that really means. Second half of life, I find, is a different story. And yet one inescapable truth for all but precious few of us, is that a couple of generations from now, no one will know or remember or care that you even walk the earth. So given that reality, what matters? I have to come back to Rosalind Carter, that the bricks are straight, this very moment. And yes, while I'm focusing on this brick in front of me, I have to be mindful and attuned to all of the overwhelming problems plaguing our world. But when it comes down to me taking my last breath, what will I say matters then? In my role as an oncology chaplain, I would say I'm sort of in the coming out business. I'm creating a safe space for people to come out to me, to tell me their truth, often their deepest truth, and often at the most critical time of their lives, at the end of it. But the way I see it, it's not only a coming out business, it's also a meaning-making business. Because once that truth is out there on the table, how do I contain it? How do I make sense of it? That's part of the gift and exhilaration of getting to do this work. Every day, I get that constant reminder, pay attention, Michael. Particularly as I move well into the third act of my life. when I reflect back on Acts 1 and 2, I realize how seldom it was that I was ever focused on the brick in front of me. I always had my eye around the corner to the next thing, the next choice, the next ordeal. How does this decision affect that one? Which class do I take? What do I major in? Which career do I pursue? Which relationships do I encourage and nurture to get me closer to wherever it is that I think I want to go? What's going to make me happy? And of course, that's still kind of true in a way, but maybe with less urgency. But perhaps with even more urgency, because at this stage in my life, the big what's next for me now is the home stretch, the final reckoning, as it were. So given that reality, what matters? When I'm taking my last breath, what will I say matters then? There are, of course, as many answers to that question as there are people on the planet. And yet I do hear common themes from folks who are wrestling with that very question before deciding to sign up for guaranteed more suffering with the next chemo treatment, the next drug trial, the next radiation, the next surgery. What is it that makes life worth fighting for? Well, I'd like to live long enough to see my son graduate high school or college, or to see my daughter get married. I'd love to see my grandchild be born. Still, I find those to be deceptively simple, tidy answers that seldom reveal the whole picture. Many years ago, I worked in the bone marrow transplant unit at UCLA Medical Center, leukemia and lymphoma patients mostly, who often spent many weeks, if not months, in the hospital. And there I met Leon, who was a difficult, prickly guy, not at all likable. In all of his weeks in the hospital, I never saw that he had a single visitor, and he was sort of proud of that. "I don't need anybody," he would say, with a certain kind of pride. He had his own business, and he had a dog who scared the neighbors. Leon identified as an atheist, a secular Jew. He presumed I was religious and a Christian, neither of which are true. But he used to enjoy duking it out with me, philosophically speaking. So that was the nature of my spiritual care. We would engage in these deep, long, philosophical, theological discussions. Once he finally got his bone marrow transplant, things went south very quickly. And the docs came in with that awful news. "There's nothing more we can do, Leon. I'm sorry." Well, then the heart began to soften and the tears came. But the very next day, the docs came in and said, "Wait, we think you might qualify for this new drug trial." Oh, his spirits went through the roof. Mine too. "This is great news, Leon. Tell me, what are you gonna do with more time if you get it?" I eagerly wanted to know. "I'd like to finish my invoicing," he said. My heart just sank. In total judgment, I admit, and disappointment, I was not a good chaplain in that moment. I did not ask the next obvious question. "Oh, that's interesting. Tell me, why are your invoices so important to you?" No, I just sat there in stunned silence. I guess I was hoping he would say, "I'd like to walk my dog on the beach one more time. I'd like to see one more beautiful sunset. I'd like to hear Rhapsody in Blue one more time." "No," he said, "I'd like to finish my invoicing." That's where he found his meaning. That's what mattered. Marianne was in her mid-40s. She had lived the previous several years with pancreatic cancer, and I walked the last few months of her journey by her side. Not long before she died, I went to see her in the hospital, and she was just cooked, absolutely fried, hooked up to every kind of tube and pump and hose imaginable. "Michael, that's it. I'm really done. I want to let go, but I can't." It wasn't an option, you see, because of course her husband and her kids wanted her to keep fighting, try the next drug trial, have the next surgery, get a second opinion, a third opinion, a fifth opinion. Michael, I can't die having them think for the rest of their lives that I didn't love them enough to keep fighting. Is that what you think? That they will think of me? What would you like, Marianne, if you could call the shots right now? Oh, that's easy, she said. I would disconnect all of this. I'd ask my husband to get in bed with me and hold me and look out that window across the room at that tree across the street. Say, isn't that beautiful? Look at how that one leaf captures the sunlight and flutters in the breeze. Isn't that something? A God moment, she would call it. Over our months of conversation, she had told me about other God moments that she had had, moments that sort of anchored her into life, moments in which not much really happened, in which the stuff and business of life just fell away, leaving space, room for an awareness of this moment, being beautiful and being enough. I'd like one more God moment, she said. I met Evelyn on her first day of chemotherapy after being newly diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She came to see me regularly every couple weeks for a session over the next 6 years. Though she never wanted to talk about anything, it seemed, of any more consequence than what she and her husband Gene had done the previous weekend. Despite all my efforts and invitation to hold the door open, to talk about the other deeper themes and questions coming down the pike, she never took the bait. I didn't feel like I was doing much of anything, but she always concluded our visits saying, Michael, thank you so much. I always feel so much better just talking to you. I went to see her in the hospital the day before she died. Her husband, Gene, was there, of course. They had been married just forever. No kids, though, high school sweethearts. The Buddhists believe it's a good idea when one is nearing their own death to be reflecting upon the good memories of the life one was leaving, that it somehow might grease the wheels for the next incarnation. No matter what our beliefs are about such things, it's not a bad idea. So I asked Gene, tell me that story again about how you guys met. I love that story. And he launched into the story, and soon enough, Evelyn was getting a little distressed. She didn't remember. Undaunted, Gene pressed on, oh, sure you do, honey. Remember we went to that football game and we were in the back seat of the car with our friends? No. The memory was gone forever. So Gene changed course. That's okay, honey. Maybe you're just tired. Tell you what, Michael and I will go out in the hall, give you a chance to rest. How about that? No, she said defiantly. I'm not tired. I don't want to rest. I want you both here. I just don't want anybody to talk. I got on one edge of the bed. Gene sat on the other edge of the bed, and we each held a hand, and we just sat there in silence, looking at one another, just holding the space, absolutely nothing to do, absolutely nothing to say, just awareness of love itself beyond words. For the rest of my life, that has imprinted my heart with an image of what truly sacred space looks like. Perhaps what matters most is what's left when everything that we thought had mattered had burnt away. So what matters to me today, in this moment? This conversation matters. Kindness really matters. Friendship, love, of course. Being a witness to one another in our lives as they are. Kinship, communion. I love that word. It's an old-fashioned religious word, but I love the idea and imagery of it, to take in and digest our common humanity, our connection to each other, to nature, to the source of life. That matters. Sure, I'd like to think when I'm breathing my last breath that I'll be able to say I made a difference. I relieved some suffering here and there. I provided some encouragement. That I had a blast. That I saw the world. That I loved hard. But I am not so grandiose as to think it was ever anything more than one conversation at a time, one brick at a time. We go through our lives having countless contacts and engagement with others, maybe a little encouragement here, a little support there. That, those contacts may be the farthest reaching impact we have on the planet. They may be our greatest legacy while we're thinking it's all about our noble work or whatever. Joseph Campbell believes it's important to realize the eternal within, to participate with joy in the sorrows of the world. I come back to that again and again as a kind of a mantra, to participate with joy in the sorrows of the world. I don't know. Maybe it just comes down to being moved by life. So be it. Thank you.